Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. My special guest today is Craig Maxwell. Craig, a lot of you may know, is the owner of Maxwell's Book in La Mesa, but he also owns a vacation home in Cuyamaca. And he's an avid outdoorsman, hiker, has been a volunteer in many of the major environmental groups in town, and he is raising some very serious questions about the controlled burn that the State Park Service and CAL FIRE conducted on February 25th inside Rancho Cuyamaca State Park. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Miriam.
Now, as background, the burn was announced to be planned at about 97 acres. And of course, controlled burns have long been considered an important part of fire control and preventing the kind of devastating fires that we had during 2003 and 2007. But you've raised some very serious questions, as have some other readers, about this particular burn. As background, I understand that during the 2003 fire, over 99% of the pine trees in Rancho Cuyamaca State Park were lost, correct?
That is correct. Yeah, it was a little island of coniferous forest, and it was almost completely decimated.
Yeah, I know that was heartbreaking for many San Diegans, certainly myself included, who loved driving through and visiting the forest. But one part that was preserved was the area right around Lake Cuyamaca, where the fire managed to jump that, or they managed to save that, the buildings around the lake and stuff that's the most popular attraction up there. Now, when you heard about the controlled burn, you decided that you were going to go up and take a look for yourself. Tell me why you did that and what you found.
Well, I was worried. And even from where I was watching the fire, seeing the smoke, I should be specific, I noticed that it was getting bigger. The plume was widening and starting to cast sort of a pale, sort of a miniature cloud level over Cuyamaca Peak. And I thought, this looks like a pretty big controlled burn. This looks like something beyond what might have been originally anticipated. And I wasn't getting up-to-date news, so I thought, I'm going to drive up there.
Yeah, there has been some controversy in that CAL FIRE only announced this burn after it started, or the morning of the burn. And a lot of our readers called us, emailed us, texted us with concerns because it was a large plume of smoke. And we have reached out and asked CAL FIRE and also State Parks to make sure that they let us know earlier in the future so that we can let our readers know with our Viejas wildfire alerts. So when you arrived, tell me where exactly this fire was burning.
Well, I saw the big plume of smoke as I was coming up 79, and by the time I reached Paso Picacho, I was right in the thick of it.
Which is what campgrounds...
That's right.
Oh,
and
okay.
There was a ranger standing at the gate to Paso Picacho. And I pulled up and asked him what was going on. And he said, oh, we're just cleaning up a little bit around the camp. And I said, sure seems like a big cleanup to me. I said, is the fire under control? I noticed that there are helicopters down here. Is everything okay? And he said, yes, everything's okay. He said, it's jumped the bounds a few times, but nothing to worry about.
When I talked to CAL FIRE on the phone, they denied that this had jumped the bounds. However, a Ramona newspaper quoted a different CAL FIRE official and said that it had, and certainly we know that they were calling in helicopters, which is not customary on a controlled burn.
It is not. And you spoke with CAL FIRE, right?
Yes.
Okay, I was talking to a park ranger.
Yeah.
So he admitted that it had jumped the bounds, but was still under control. And again, the fire was big enough. I could see some flames from where I was parked and talking to him.
Now, if you can lay out for us, where was this fire in relation to the lake? Maybe you can even list some of the roads for our listeners familiar with the area.
Sure. This fire was on the lower flank of Cuyamaca Peak. It would be just to the west of the campground itself, and going up the lower flank of Cuyamaca Peak. It would be bounded in by Cold Creek on the south side and Milk Ranch Road on the north. So it was almost right in between those two landmarks.
So this would be the south side of Lake Cuyamaca. How far from the lake?
half a mile at the most, quarter of a mile.
So you could see what they were burning from Lake Cuyamaca.
Certainly. And I, you know, it was then that I decided I'm going to get a look for myself. So I parked at Milk Ranch Road. I hiked up the road and then hiked up the flank of Middle Peak to get an elevated view or perspective of the fire. And it was from that position that I took some of the pictures that you featured in your article.
Yeah, they were very disturbing. They appeared to show pine trees or cedars, hard to tell which, but what appeared to be healthy, green, you know, cedars or pine trees in flames, fire, smoke all around. You wrote to us that you saw mature cedars, oaks, and pine trees being burned.
Mature trees and saplings. So some of the trees that had survived the fire, and as you pointed out, there weren't many.
Oh, you would think that with less than 1%, they'd
That's right. That's right.
Take steps to protect those.
Yeah, some of the mature trees were on fire, and as I got closer to the fire and I could see some of the smaller saplings, trees that had come up in the wake of the cedar fire, I noticed that they were being burned too. There were also deciduous trees that had survived the fire that were on fire, and a lot of what I call root growth, trees that had come up in the wake of the cedar fire from the roots of the dead trees. And some of these are 10, 12 feet high now. They were on fire. Oh. So it was an indiscriminate burn.
Now, biologists had said after the cedar fire, damage to Cuyamaca State Park was so severe that it might never return, certainly wouldn't in our lifetime take 100 years minimum, and that because of climate change, it might never return. It could come back as high desert or oak scrub forest, and that steps should really be taken to encourage and protect reseeding efforts. And so it's very surprising to a lot of people that this kind of burning of mature pine trees and, from what you're saying now, seedlings was going on.
I agree.
Now, we reached out to State Park Service and we've asked them for answers. And so far, troublingly, they have not responded. We're going to keep trying. We're going to go higher up and go to the Sacramento office and try to get some answers. But in the meantime, we did bring this to the attention of Supervisor Diane Jacob and Assemblyman Brian Jones. We were very specific. We sent them photos showing what was burning, the description of these pines and things, as well as the fact that over 99% of the pines previously burned. And this was their responses. I'd love to hear your reaction to these, Craig. First of all, Supervisor Jacob says, "I'm a big believer in controlled burns because they reduce the odds of a massive firestorm. Our region learned the hard way in 2003 and 2007 that unchecked overgrown vegetation can fuel deadly disasters. I don't want to see those again on my watch, and I know state and local fire authorities don't either. Controlled burns and other forms of vegetation management protect our communities, and I rely on our fire officials to identify appropriate locations and carry them out safely."
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that sounds like a political boilerplate to me. That sounds like a canned answer. And it's not a very thoughtful one because I can see the point of controlled burns under certain circumstances.
Sure.
I'm not against controlled burns per se. I don't think any of us are. And to a degree, we have to trust our officials in circumstances like this. But these things can get out of control very easily. You remember the San Felipe fire, which
yes.
began as a controlled fire and wound up damn near burning the whole of Vulcan Mountain.
Yeah, I think it was 1,200 or 1,400 acres. It was very,
right.
very large.
Yeah, it became a real threat to the park up there.
Now, here's what Assemblyman Brian Jones had to say. "Cal Fire is comprised of well-trained fire professionals who conduct prescribed burns as a way to protect the ecology of the forest and to ensure unplanned fires do not start during the hotter months of the year. I have been told by Cal Fire that acreage was predetermined prior to the prescribed burns and that they monitored the weather minute by minute and conducted spot weather forecasts throughout the Rancho Cuyamaca burn this week. While I understand the need to conserve our precious state parks, unfortunately, these types of controlled burns are necessary to help firefighters with unplanned fires during a fire season that has the potential to be devastating because of this year's drought conditions." And I might add this was done, statement was made before the current deluge of rains that are sweeping in as we record this.
Yeah. Again, you know, political boilerplate and, you know, a fair amount of professional, I'll euphemistically call it fanny covering. I don't like those responses at all, and I'm really disappointed to hear both of those were phrased that way. They don't tell us anything.
Now, we're going to be reaching out to try to get some expert opinions on this. We're going to be trying to bring in some biology experts, botany experts, wildlife experts, from universities in the region, from perhaps the Museum of Natural History, major environmental organizations, and so forth. And so, listeners, we certainly welcome. If you're an expert in one of these fields or can help put us in touch with people, we would love to have some come out, walk the area, take a look at these photos, these videos. And we certainly also, again, we welcome the opportunity for the State Park Service, as well as CAL FIRE, to come on the show next week and tell us their side of the story on this. Craig, do you have any final parting words on this?
Yes. I guess my parting words would be, you know, I know that there are some people who are upset that we're questioning the rationale that's been given by the professional firefighters, and we're not so much doubting them. We're just saying there were things that looked unorthodox about this burn, and perhaps reflected, that may have reflected bad judgment. And this is from a layman's perspective. You know, I'm no expert myself, but there were incongruities in the story that we were told. You know, differences between what CAL FIRE told us and the state parks told us. Mm-hmm. I spoke with a retired park official, you know, who told me that fire parameters are elastic, that they can change if the fire has jumped the original boundaries that were established.
So in other words, they can change the size of the control burn they announce after the fact?
That's right. This can almost be a sort of make-it-up-as-you-go scenario. And I found that disturbing. And so we just want some information. And we have filed a Freedom of Information Act request with CAL FIRE and with the State Park Service. And we'll find out what they tell us.
Yeah, and I think we also should file one with the Cleveland National Forest and the U.S. Forest Service, because there was a second controlled burn that hasn't gotten as much publicity going on the same day. A lot of people were reporting seeing two heads of what appeared to be a big fire. And in fact, it was two different fires.
Yeah.
But that was inside Cleveland National Forest. And we don't know yet how large that one was or what type of terrain was burned. But we've certainly also had a lot of concern among our readers. We've had many, many, many emails, calls from people who have a lot of questions, such as, it was windy that day, people have said, and they question why the burn was not called off. People have voiced concern about wildlife in the area. What is this doing to the ground-burying animals, the nesting birds? We know there's eagles that nest not far from there, for example, other raptors. What does it do to the wildlife when you're continually doing these burns? These are all questions that I think deserve some more serious answers, and I would have to agree with you, Craig, that while I'm not often one to be critical of public officials, I would have liked to see something more in terms of some serious questioning of state parks as to why this burn was ordered at all. Why are steps not being taken to protect the last remaining stands of pine trees if you have dead wood or something non-native in the area, or whatever other problems there might be? Why are those not being addressed in these very small stands of pines that are left through other means, through chipping, through hand weeding? You know, there seems like there could be some other options besides a very indiscriminate and large controlled burn.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
This is Ed Barreno with a sports report. A San Diego State University staff member who lost a leg in Afghanistan has been honored by the San Diego Hall of Champions. Eric McElvaney was named Challenged Athlete of the Year at the Salute to the Champions Awards ceremony after accomplishments that would be daunting for many able-bodied athletes. A former Marine captain who was stationed at Camp Pendleton, he volunteered for a tour of duty in Afghanistan in 2011, where he was wounded by an improvised explosive device. His leg had to be amputated below the knee. But it hasn't slowed him down. "I set a goal that when the other three members of my unit returned in mid-April, I'd be there to greet them, standing," vowed McElvaney, who did just that. Just 8 months after losing his leg, he competed in his first spring triathlon. 2 months later, he ran his first marathon. He went on to compete in the grueling Ironman triathlon in Hawaii last summer, which includes a 2.5-mile swim, a 112-mile bike race, and a 26-mile marathon. Even for the fittest competitors, it's one of the most challenging events of its kind. McElvaney finished in 11 hours and 50 minutes. Nowadays, he enjoys mentoring veterans. After transitioning from battlefield to civilian life at SDSU, McElvaney is assistant director of the Troops to Engineers program, With their military backgrounds, many of these students are finding careers in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. It's something bigger than me, says McElvaney, who knows firsthand the importance of help and support. In accepting his award, he praised the Challenge Athletes Foundation and the San Diego community for assisting him in attaining his dreams. While he has been focused on his training and his goals, he said the award came as a surprise. To have the community recognize those accomplishments was a really cool experience, he concluded.
This is Leon Thompson with the East County Magazine and KNSJ with some good news for the directionally challenged. California's 5th District Court of Appeals has ruled that it is legal for a driver to check a map application on a cell phone. So if you're lost, you can look up directions on your smartphone, but you can't make a phone call or text, the court found. The case involves a Fresno motorist who fought a $165 traffic ticket after he checked his cell phone looking for an alternate route while stuck in a traffic tie-up. The lower court ruled against him, but judges on the Court of Appeals overturned it and found in the motorist's favor. The judges reasoned that the law was passed before iPhones were invented, back when people used phones mainly for talking or sending text messages. The court rejected the state's argument that any hands-on use of a phone should be illegal, concluding that it would be absurd to prohibit merely checking the time or other displays on your phone. But before you start mapping your way around a traffic jam the next time you're stuck in traffic, be aware that this case could still be appealed to the California Supreme Court. So the verdict is still out on whether using a map app while driving may lead to hefty fines.
A federal court has ruled that two laws passed as a result of ballot initiatives in California are unconstitutional. Both measures imposed more severe punishments than were in place when crimes were committed, ruled U.S. District Judge Lawrence Carlton. Prop 9, the Victims' Bill of Rights, had required longer time periods between parole hearings. Prop 89 had allowed the governor to reverse paroles granted for convicted murderers. The judge issued an injunction to prohibit enforcement of these two laws. The ruling in the class action case, Gilman v. Brown, could impact thousands of prisoners currently in California prisons. Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Sick workers, particularly in the food service industry, pose risks to public health. But nearly half of all local workers in the private sector lack paid sick time, including 80% of employees in food service. That leaves workers a choice of coming to work sick or losing pay. A new analysis by the Institute for Women's Policy Research finds that 44% of San Diego's private sector employees lack access to a single earned sick day. Among Hispanic workers here, 55% don't have a single sick day. Earned sick days are especially uncommon in jobs that require frequent contact with the public. More than 80% of employees working in food services and about half of employees in the hotel industry lack access to earned sick days. Earned sick days allow workers to take time off when they are ill without fear of being fired. Previous research shows that about half of all workers who are covered by earned sick days plans don't take any days off for illness or injury in any given year. When used, however, this earned time allows workers and their families to obtain health care more promptly, leading to improved health outcomes, speedier recoveries, and a more productive workforce. Employers may believe scrimping on offering sick time saves them money, but earned sick days can reduce both business and public health costs by cutting down on the spread of disease at work, so employers don't lose productivity. It also boosts morale among workers. Earned sick days are an inexpensive but important tool for promoting public health by minimizing contagion and giving workers the opportunity to seek health services or care for their families, concludes Barbara Galt, Vice President and Executive Director at the Institute for Women's Policy Research.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and KNSJ with an update from Sacramento. Democrats have lost the supermajority in the state Senate, which means they can no longer pass tax measures or constitutional amendments without at least one Republican vote. That could mean a return to the partisan divide and gridlock in Sacramento. Currently, Democrats are one vote short of that two-thirds supermajority due to the conviction of Senator Rod Reid on felony perjury charges, and a second senator, Ron Calderon, who is facing criminal charges. Both of these senators have taken leaves of absences for the moment. One of these is leaving office soon due to term limits. The other may either resign or be forced to leave office when his sentencing occurs in May. So there will be a special election for voters to choose a replacement, and Democrats could regain their supermajority by summer. But come November, the balance of power could shift yet again when voters head to the polls.
First thing we're going to do today, we're going to do the puppet game. Let's see if we can pick one out of here.
A tomato, a tomato.
Nutrition has a couple of new champions.
Hi, I'm Pat Laughlin. We're here at Quimaca Preschool, and we're here to teach and encourage the kids to eat fruits and vegetables and learn all about them.
And the other is Lydia Combs.
Today, we chopped vegetables, tasting, eating, discussing vitamins and nutrients.
Oh, soup would be good with carrots in it.
They're known as the garden grandmas.
Some of the kids call us garden ladies. We like garden ladies, too.
You know where raisins come from?
We're encouraging them to think of different ways to eat different fruits and encourage their friends to eat them. Tell us how you like to eat tomatoes. We use the magic elixir, which is ranch dressing. They'll almost try anything long as it has ranch dressing.
They don't have to eat everything, but they can try it. It's a choice. Sometimes they don't do it all, and sometimes they will really enjoy it and do it all, and they'll look forward to seeing you come every week.
Start off with one, and if you like them, you
can take one.
All right, then take two if you like them.
The Cuyamaca College 5 and Fit Nutrition Program incorporates the county's intergenerational program.
The kids get a chance to interact with older adults in a way that they might not otherwise get an opportunity. Some of them may not have grandparents that are nearby. For the older adults, it's really great because they get a chance to be engaged in their community. They're less likely to be depressed. And what we found is that the adults that are participating in the program tell us they're actually eating better, too, as a result of participating in the program.
I eat with them. I may try out some recipes to see what's interesting, what tastes good.
One thing Pat and Lydia try to do is to get the kids to involve their parents at home.
If the children go shopping with their parents to the grocery store, maybe they'll point out something and they'll say, that's a Brussels sprout. And maybe their parent will pick that up and say, do you like this? It'll be an introduction for their parents and for them, too, into taking that fruit or vegetable home and making it part of their diet.
You gonna water the artichoke?
I just look forward to my Monday mornings. I don't think I'd ever miss one. They all have their own different little personalities, and they have come to enjoy us and look forward to us coming, too. So it's, you know, it's just a win-win.
The County News Center, I'm Jose Villanueva.
By an 8-1 vote, the San Diego City Council has voted to create new zoning laws allowing up to 30 medical marijuana dispensaries within the city limits, up to 4 in each council district. Interim Mayor Todd Gloria, in one of his final actions before turning over leadership of the city to incoming Mayor Kevin Faulkner, said the ordinance provides clear and fair rules to allow medical marijuana patients access while protecting neighborhoods from potential negative impacts. To provide funds for additional code enforcement, dispensary owners must apply for a conditional use permit and pay a fee ranging from $8,000 to $24,000. The ordinance will require approval from the California Coastal Commission, which will likely rule within 90 days. Only Councilman Mark Kersey voted against the measure because he noted that marijuana is still illegal under federal law, although California voters passed an initiative allowing medical marijuana back in 1996. The Obama administration has indicated it won't prosecute over marijuana sales in states that legalized recreational use. However, marijuana is illegal at the federal level, and there are no guarantees that a future administration won't prosecute. The new zoning laws cap a 5-year battle in the city over how to regulate medical marijuana clinics. Council previously passed a strict ordinance and later rescinded it to avoid election costs after citizens qualified a measure for the ballot that would overturn the measure if passed. But a proliferation of shops, some reportedly offering marijuana on dubious medical grounds, has renewed the effort at regulation. This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ.
The body of a 57-year-old fisherman has been found after an extensive search at Lake Sutherland in Ramona. On Saturday evening, the man's kayak was found floating upside down in the lake during stormy weather. A hat and cooler believed to belong to the victim were also found, prompting a search and rescue operation. Deputies searched the shoreline with help from the sheriff's Astrea helicopter. San Diego City lifeguards also helped search the lake, which is a city reservoir. The search had to be called off overnight but resumed on Sunday when the man's body was found. According to the medical examiner, the victim was a widower. His name has not yet been released, pending notification of family. It is not known why he ventured out on the lake during the bad weather, but a park spokesman indicated there were other people also fishing at the time of his disappearance. The incident serves as a reminder that it's wise to check weather reports before heading out on a boat, and when fishing or engaging in any activities in the backcountry, it's best to bring a friend for safety's sake. Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians. The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with today's Green Scene Report. Are wind turbines safe for wildlife, livestock, and humans living nearby? A new study published in the Journal of Veterinary Sciences has found that geese living near wind turbines suffered loss of appetite, weight loss, and measurable physical changes. The study, conducted at a university in Poland, included two groups of 20 geese, about 40 total, kept in paddocks for 12 weeks. The first group was within 50 meters of a 2-megawatt Vestas wind turbine, while the second group was 500 meters away, or about 10 times as far. The study measured noise in decibels and also infrasound to which the geese were exposed. Blood tests were also taken to assess their health. Decibel levels averaged over 56 decibels where the first group was kept and 58 for the second group. Cortisol levels in the blood of geese in group 1 were significantly higher than in the second group, and the impact, oddly, was highest in males. The levels, along with behavior such as not eating, were consistent with high levels of stress. Cortisol levels actually rose in both groups compared to a control group, suggesting that even 500 meters away is not a safe distance, the researchers concluded. By the end of the study, birds nearest the turbine had lost weight, weighing in at 10% less than those farther away. Researchers concluded that the reaction of the birds confirmed that geese have a sensitive sense of hearing and are responding to both audible sounds and infrasound. They recommended that further studies be done to determine safe distances for keeping animals when wind turbines are present. Here in San Diego County, where wind turbines are proposed in rural areas and wildlife habitat, and some have already been built, the study raises troubling questions. How safe are turbines near chickens, cattle, horses, or other livestock commonly found in our region, or for that matter, pets? Moreover, what about impacts on wildlife, such as nesting birds, burrowing animals, or even bighorn sheep? Anecdotes from around the world for several years now have suggested that livestock kept near wind turbines exhibit signs of stress as well as reproductive problems such as stillbirths, but no scientific studies have been done to determine whether indeed wind turbines were the cause, until now. Now, the Polish study, though preliminary in its results, lends some weight to concerns raised over the safety of wind turbines near animals and humans and suggests a need for caution when considering wind turbines proposed near residential areas, agricultural lands, or wildlife preserves.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, The Scanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. And I'm delighted today to welcome to our show Martin Eder, who is the Executive Director of Activist San Diego and Acting Station Manager for KNSJ. But really, he's the vision and the power behind the founding of our radio station, KNSJ. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here with you.
For those readers that aren't familiar with the whole history of this, how long has this radio station been a dream of yours, and how did it all get started?
I worked in community radio when I was right out of college. I worked for KCFR and became the news director there, so I've always had my thoughts, my hopes in being able to do and work in media. And I went on to be a news director at KBDI TV 12 in Denver.
That's a wonderful experience.
But it's not a profession where you can easily get a job, or very few paid positions, right, and things like that. So I did all kinds of other work, and it wasn't until I finished kind of my teaching career that I luckily ran across the notice that the FCC had opened up the radio spectrum for new non-commercial educational radio stations.
Right. And this was really the last FM license, they were saying, that would be given out maybe ever in San Diego. So that must have been really competitive. How many others were vying for that same bit of bandwidth?
Actually, we applied for two different stations, Descanso being the one that we got, and the one that's been up on the air since July 4th of this year. The other in Ramona that's been hung up by the FCC, and we have been...
That's on Los Coyotes Peak, right?
Los Coyotes, Indian Reservation, Hot Springs Mountain up in 6,700 feet. And
nice.
If we ever do get that, it will be the first solar and wind-powered radio station in the state of California.
Oh, that's very exciting.
So we're continuing to work on trying to increase on that, and things are still there for us. But 89.1 Descanso, serving the San Diego border region, is something that took us 6.5 years from application to construction. And luckily, they had depoliticized the process a number of years ago, and it was based on a point system and technical qualifications. And we had a wonderful radio engineer who has worked with a lot of community radio stations, who put us in one of the most difficult locations, but figuring that one way or another, we were going to make the thing work, and by the skin of our teeth, we were able to get it done within the FCC guidelines at great difficulty. And we're just delighted that what came out of that effort was a signal that though small, can be heard everywhere from Torrey Pines State Beach all the way to Imperial Beach, and probably 200,000 to 300,000 people in Tijuana.
Yeah, that's huge. It was just a wonderful surprise at how far that signal is going. Now, tell us a little bit about the vision behind the station, Martin. I know that Activist San Diego, for those who aren't familiar with it, is an umbrella group that has, as members, many different activist groups, everything from environmental groups to peace groups to groups that are fighting for, you know, all kinds of different causes. What is the sort of the mission statement behind the station?
Well, starting with Activist San Diego, which was founded on Earth Day in 2009, set out to be a network for social justice. And by social justice, we meant any one of the numerous causes of human rights, civil rights, women's rights, immigrant rights, educational equality, all of the things that kind of progress a society towards more equity within the society, more access, all with the underlying theme of emboldening our democracy and citizen participation. So we call ourselves an information, communications, and mobilization network. So when the opportunity for a radio station came up, we did not think that we would end up or wanted to end up to be the license holder, but definitely wanted to help others in the community to do so. Yeah. And we gathered, as you say, a coalition of people to make the application jointly. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, having a bit more of a structure, even though we were a very small and underfunded community organization, it was Activist San Diego that ended up being able to shepherd the about 500-step process to get the radio station going, 500 milestones, tremendous technical issues and financial issues to be able to do that. And so the mission of community radio station is to give voice to the voiceless, is to be able to provide an opportunity that has not been available to those who seek airtime on commercial radio,
right,
where you basically have to pay to get your message out. Yeah. And so we want to be that part of the spectrum that allows new voices in there and community voices, well, grassroots voices.
Wonderful goal, and we're all so glad that it's been successful. Now, let's talk a little bit about the programming. Like all new stations, of course, the programming is evolving. You launched it on July 4th, Independence Day, independent media for our region.
Exactly.
Tell us about some of the programming that's been recently added and what else might be coming down the pike, both local programming and also some nationally syndicated shows.
So right now, I would say, coin the term that we are on KNSJ version 1.1, and we're only 5% of what we would like to be. We have a lot of nationally syndicated programs that do not require much on our end. Most notably, Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez, Democracy Now! Is on 7 to 8 a.m. in the morning, and also 6 to 7 in the evening. A wonderful, wonderful, deeply enriching program that does investigative reporting on other parts of the news. And I often say, if you are not listening to Democracy Now!, you really lose perspective on what it is that's happening in our country and around the world.
Yeah, she has some amazing stories on that program. Now, you also have some environmental shows, some Native American programming, which would be of interest to our many Native American tribal members out here in East County. What are some of those programs, and when can people tune in to hear them?
You mentioned environmental programs. We are running Sierra Club's weekly focus. It goes very much along with many of what we want to do, and that is believing that an informed community is an engaged community. We want citizens to get involved in things. And groups like Sierra Club don't just put out information about some of the environmental degradation, but actually give people an opportunity to get involved, not just with their organizations, but with other. We have other programs on the environmental thing. Eco Shock is a particularly good one. We have several science programs that are quite engaging. Big Science. And some of the other notable large programs, well known, I think you're very much familiar with Tom Hartman.
Yes.
Tom Hartman is nationally syndicated on, several hundred stations, but nobody in San Diego had covered. Just like Democracy Now! On 500 stations, we are the first local station to air. Amy Goodman, we were the largest city in the United States to not have Democracy Now.
Wow, and so you feel
that. And when
that
you
void.
Hear it, you'll recognize, okay, this is something, this is information that I definitely have been missing, and I'm enriched by it.
Right. And then the Native American programming, tell us about that.
NV1, which is the national network of 300 stations, mm-hmm. has a series of programs. Native American Calling is a live call-in show on Native American issues. It's every day, Monday through Friday, 10 to 11 a.m. coming out of Albuquerque. Today they were talking about hunting on the reservations. Other times it's education or jobs,
cultural
enrichment, mm-hmm. all of those preservation, mm-hmm. all of those things are
very important.
Very, very important, I guess, in terms of Native American, you know, particularly here in San Diego County with more Indian reservations than any other county in the United
States.
Right.
A lot of people don't realize that.
Yes.
What other shows do you think our listeners would like to hear about, Martin?
We do have a number of shows produced right here. Vincent Farnsworth with the local media Monitor, listening in on other radio stations and
giving a
very interesting look at some of the facts presented there and challenging some of those points of view from a very intelligent position. Jason Smothers has a show called The 99% Show, looking at the class divide in the United States. And with that lens, taking a look at the world and what's happening locally. We're pleased to announce that we are going to be beginning a show with Mike Aguirre.
Oh, my.
And
former city
attorney. Several of those have been. Mike Aguirre is a person with extraordinary insights into how the city works. He is a lawyer and a muckraker.
What will be the
candidate for mayor? You know, but now that he's not a candidate, we can have him on the radio.
So will it be a political talk show or analysis, or what will it be?
It's going to be news and analysis, but very much talking about what's going on behind the scenes, who's pulling the strings.
So focus on San Diego politics.
Yes, very much, and local and regional. Based, and he's doing that together with Douglas Holbrook.
Right. Now, I understand that Adam Tinkle still has a show on the air also that's based right here in East County in Descanso, correct?
Yes. Adam Tinkle lives in Descanso, teaches at UCSD as well, and he has a show called Unrestricted Air. And it is a bit of local news from the Descanso region together with some old time radios and his love for music. It's a very interesting combination. We hope to get a lot more community news from places like Descanso.
Very good. Well, I'm certainly impressed with what a engaging mix of programming the stations have been able to accomplish in really such a short time. It's only been on the air 6 months, so that's really something to be commended.
And I think in the next month or so, I hope that we're going to have KNSJ 2.0 fill in many of the gaps. You know, I've got to, in some ways, almost apologize to some of our listeners that we have not filled in some of the areas that now have musical assortments that I don't think is the essence of what this station is. I mean, we definitely are going to have many locally produced music shows and want very much to make culture.
And it takes time. I know you took time, for instance, to get the license to be able to play music that's, you know, copyrighted music and the permissions and everything that are needed. So these are all things that are kind of growing pains. But if you look at even NPR, KPBS, and you look at what they were like in the early days, it's nothing at all like what they eventually grew into. So, you know, that's a point. Well,
yes, we are still a toddlers, barely out of our diapers, and we really need people in the community. This is a time, and we'll do it again more. We want people to be engaged. This is grassroots radio. We are an all volunteer operation at this point. If you are listening and you have any interest in producing, helping, technical or otherwise, and we definitely have a lot of need for people with technical expertise.
What about underwriting?
Underwriting, you know, finances are a big thing. You mentioned the $2,500, $2,800 that we ended up spending just to be able to play music on the station.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hidden costs that I think the average listener may not be aware of. And, you know, it's great to have all volunteers, but you can't pay the rent with, you know, sweat equity.
Yeah, with our ongoing expenses are
studio
$2,000 to $2,500 a month. For a small organization like this, for a community-based radio station, is just getting up. After we spent $40,000 on equipment and other services that we had to do.
Speaking of which, tell us about the new studio now. Our listeners may be excited to know that there's a radio studio coming to downtown El Cajon.
It is there. All of the essentials of the studio at 270 East Douglas are there and will be open to the community very shortly for citizen producers, for those interested, and at some point even to rent out to local people who want to do recording as well.
That's great.
But that main studio in the East County Business Association Center.
East County Business Center.
There at just in the downtown of El Cajon is readily accessible, wheelchair accessible, and we will be doing live shows from that. Our next step of programming KNSJ 2.0 is going to have live people during drive times to bring us some of the local news, traffic, and as you asked about underwriting. Underwriting is the way that nonprofit radio does what advertising does, and that is to associate your company with a product and information that listeners feel that they want to support. And for relatively small amounts of money by the standards of commercial radio, you, your organization, your business can be an underwriter of shows, the shows that you really love and support. So if it is Native American Colin or Amy Goodman or the Tom Hartman, and you want to underwrite and be associated with the listeners, absolutely. And so all of that is there, and it's an opportunity for us to give to the community and the community give to us in their donations.
Wonderful. Now, you have a very exciting event coming up that's the People's Ball, and this is a way that the community can turn out and support the radio station and also have a lot of fun and meet some wonderful people. Tell us about when and where that's going to be and some of the details.
The People's Ball has a genesis for 10 years going back. We've had some amazingly good keynote speakers and up to 750 people attending the People's Ball. The name People's Ball comes from kind of an affordable way for people to get together in a very gala event. This year, March 15th at the 2100 Park Boulevard, which is the World Beat Center, we will be having our gala event. Doors are going to be open at 6:30. We have a wonderful band in the Guinness Book of Records as the world's most traveled band, Liquid Blue.
Wow.
That has played for audiences of 65,000 people. It has played in more countries than any other band in the world as it's traveled. Very, very professional.
What type Liquid of music?
Blue. They play a mix of rock, soul, blues, oldies, and it's very much message music, very much along the issue of
dancing,
international peace. They have good singers, excellent, fabulous singers. Nikki,
so you can come out and listen
Nikki
to the music,
Green,
dance. There's a dance floor down there, right?
Yes.
And,
So there will be food available for purchase. The People's Ball, if you buy tickets in advance, they are $25, $30 at the door. You can buy tables for your groups and organizations, and it is a wonderful, wonderful event. And we expect to have a wonderful surprise, both MC and keynote speaker. Not all confirmed, so I won't put any of that down.
Well, we're looking,
People's Ball, 15th of March. Find the details at activistsandiego.org, or most importantly, please log into knsj.org. And KNSJ, by the way, if it might help you remember, is Networking for Social Justice.
That's right. And that's at 89.1 FM,
yeah.
Descanso. And I assume you can find the programming and details on all the programming, the People's Ball, and if you want to donate or underwrite, all that information is there as well.
Yes, absolutely. So that is your point of contact. We want to hear from people who are listening right now. Send us an email at info@knsj.org. Give us your opinions, positive, negative, suggestions, whatever. We want to hear from you and reflect your opinions.
Very good. Well, Martin, I want to thank you so much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, and we are really looking forward to seeing where this station is going down the road. I'm very excited. Wish we could look in our crystal ball and see the future.
Well, thank you very much, and for your involvement in East County Magazine's connection has been important to us to fill that, and you have helped in ever so many ways with fundraising and content and helping us get on our feet. And there's room, you know, the main message, there is room for a lot of people to put their energies and to see this as your community radio station. If you're out there, if you never thought about it, we will help train you to get involved and to be able to give a voice to others. And if not you, certainly, you know, help us build a station so that those other new voices can be heard.
People of color make up 60% of the Golden State, yet California's largest banks do business with a precious few of them when it comes to purchasing goods and services. That's according to a first-of-its-kind study from the Greenlining Institute. It found less than 8% of those purchases by banks in 2012 came from businesses owned by African Americans, Latinos, Asians, or Native Americans. Bruce Merkin with the Greenlining Institute says it's not acceptable when a bank's supplier network fails to reflect the diversity of California.
It's not really any conscious discrimination. It is more just an old boy network. They get used to using certain suppliers that they've used for years, which tend to be businesses owned by white men.
Merkin says banks are a key engine of our economy, purchasing more than $51 billion worth of goods and services in 2012. The study encourages banks and other corporations to make an effort to diversify their supplier network. Merkin says entrepreneurship is key to the American dream.
We have this enormous racial wealth gap in this country, and if we can encourage businesses in these diverse communities, the entrepreneurial spirit is certainly there. It'll help everybody, ultimately. It'll boost our whole economy.
Nationwide, the average amount of business that banks did with minority-owned suppliers was just 6%. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
This is Caprice Harrison bringing you a true tale from East County's past, a colorful chapter from our history that may soon be revived. Ernest Dahlman, Chief Executive Officer of Pacific Imperial Railroad, has announced he has signed a 99-year lease with the San Diego and Arizona Eastern Railway Company and is raising funds to restore and operate the Desert Line tracks through mountains and deserts in San Diego, Imperial County, and Baja, Mexico. He hopes it'll link up with the trolley and train lines in San Diego, as well as a transcontinental railway route to the east. The route in East County includes the rugged Carrizo Gorge, once a pinnacle of engineering accomplishment on what early engineers called the Impossible Railroad. The idea for the railway started with Edward Harriman, who controlled the Union Pacific Railroad and Southern Pacific lines. He partnered with sugar mogul John D. Spreckles, who, despite numerous ownership changes and calamities, led the Herculean effort to complete the line. Groundbreaking was held in 1907, but soon after, a depression caused funds to dry up. Then Harriman died, and his heirs canceled the contract with Spreckles, who raised the money on his own. In 1910, the first passengers were carried to Agua Caliente Hot Springs, but the next year, revolutions broke out in Mexico, and workers left their jobs until the rebels surrendered. Next, Southern Pacific sued Spreckles, trying to get back $3 million it had advanced, but the suit was later dismissed. World War I broke out in Europe. There was no money for railroad construction. The line, it seemed, was cursed. In 1916, the worst floods ever to strike San Diego at that time washed out dams and roads, flooding Campo Creek. An engine derailed and sunk in the mud. In 1917, the U.S. government seized all the major railroads to fuel the war effort, and construction halted. Spreckles went to Washington, D.C. and convinced the government to grant an exception, arguing that the line was vital for defense due to military installations in San Diego. Finally, construction began on the toughest stretch of tracks, the steep and rocky Carrizo Gorge. Plans called for 17 tunnels along the 11-mile stretch. A cave-in killed a workman who was buried in the collapse. Work was also slowed by the influenza epidemic worldwide, which sickened many in the construction camp. Finally, the work was complete, and the Gold Spike Limited made its run from San Diego to the Carrizo Gorge station. Spreckles jumped down, pulled off his coat, and drove in a solid gold spike on November 15, 1919. In its heyday, the line carried passengers to the Agua Caliente racetrack, a popular spot during Prohibition, and provided a vital connection from San Diego to Arizona. But the tale doesn't end there. Rock slides delayed trains repeatedly, sometimes for weeks at a time. Flash floods, a fire that burned for 4 days, and even a hurricane wreaked havoc with the tracks. The railway also faced competition from automobiles as the horseless carriages gained popularity. After Spreckle's death, the heirs sold off their interests, and ultimately, the California Public Utilities Commission granted permission to shut down the line. The last train ran its final run in January 1951. You can still ride the rails on an old-time train from the line at the Railway Museum in Tampa. But someday soon, East County residents may once again hear the whistle and the roar of trains across the line that traverse some of our region's most rugged and spectacularly beautiful terrain, if Ernest Dahlman succeeds in his dream to restore the line.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.